Hello, and good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Friends Evening Lecture. I'm so glad to see you all here tonight. I'm Jessica Cassidy, manager of the Friends Program. And on behalf of the Friends Program Committee and its co-chairs Lynn Goldberg and Wendy Nicholson, I'd like to welcome you to the evening. For those of you who are current members, I also want to thank you for your support of the library. As you all know, these are challenging times, and history has shown in the past that during challenging times like these, New Yorkers turn to the library more than ever before, and we're already seeing a huge increase in the numbers of patrons this year. So I hope that you will consider renewing your support again and increasing your gift in order to meet the needs of these millions of users. If you're not a member, I hope you'll consider joining. We do have a membership table by the door. Just a few housekeeping notes. If you could please turn off your cell phones as a courtesy to our speaker and everyone else in the room. Also, after the lecture, Mr. Aldo will answer questions, and I'd like to point out the two microphones on either side of the room. If you could please use the microphones to ask your questions, that would be very helpful. Well, Alan Aldo really needs no introduction from me. We are honored to have him here tonight. Mr. Alda is an acting, directing, and writing legend, and he's won 6 Emmys and 6 Golden Globes. He, of course, played Hawkeye Pierce for 11 years on MASH and wrote and directed many of the episodes of that beloved and groundbreaking series. In 2005, when his first book, I have to get this right, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned, became a New York Times bestseller. He also had the distinction of being nominated for an Oscar for Martin Scorsese's The Aviator, an Emmy for his work on The West Wing, and a Tony for his work in Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway. So that was quite a year. In 2007, Mr. Alda's second book, Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself, also became an instant bestseller. After a near-death experience, Mr. Alda wrote this book to reflect on life's difficult and elusive questions that we don't have answers for, questions that he'd asked himself publicly and privately for many years. And he truly has a talent for threading personal experience, introspection, and world events into an entertaining and very inspiring story. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Alda.
Hi, hello. Thank you. Thank you. What a treat to see you here. Thank you very much. You know, when the library called, they said, would you come and speak at the public library because we have 13 million books here and yours is the best one. And I said, well, sure. This is a scene from the movie, I Wish. This book, Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself, is sort of a memoir. But most memoirs start at the beginning, and this one starts at what was almost the end of everything. It was almost exactly 5 years ago that this thing happened to me. It was October 19th, and I was in Chile. And I was up on top of a mountain, 8,000 feet up, at an observatory, and I was interviewing astronomers for the science program I did for 11 years, Scientific American Frontiers. And this was the last interview we were doing at the end of the 10th year. So, I mean, I'd done this a lot, and I was sitting on a bench waiting for them to light the part of the observatory where we were going to do the interview. And I started to feel a tickle in my stomach, in my gut. And I thought, oh, that must be the chili peppers I had for lunch yesterday. They don't eat chili in Chile, you know. They don't. In fact, they don't like it to be called chili either. I don't blame them. But they don't. I ate it there. I ate these extremely hot peppers that went off the scale, you know. And I thought that must be it. But you don't get this from Chili Peppers, because the pain got worse and worse, and it was pretty soon, it was the worst thing I'd ever felt. And I was doubled up on the bench and moaning. And they had a medic up there in this observatory. I don't think he had been called on to do too much before this. He comes over to me and he looks at me all doubled up on the bench. He says, "How are you feeling?" I said, I'm in a lot of pain, and it started here, but now it's more. I think it's down over here on my right side. I think maybe I have appendicitis." He said, "Yeah, I think so too." I was not real reassured about this guy at this point. But they had an ambulance up there, and they put me in the ambulance. It was one of these real, must have been 50 years old, this ambulance, a big boxy thing. It looked just like the ambulances we had on MASH. And it ran like that, too. They couldn't get it started. So I'm lying in the back of the ambulance screaming and moaning. It's the worst pain you can feel. And they're banging on the motor. And finally, they got it started. And they take me down the mountain on a bumpy mountain road, an hour and a half down the mountain. And they take me to this kind of dingy emergency room in a little hospital in a town that's not one of the biggest towns in Chile, called La Serena. And I'll give you an idea of this. This emergency room has like one bare light bulb hanging on a cord. And I found out later about this. The guy across the room from me, on a table, a gurney across the room, he was there because of a self-inflicted knife wound. And the reason he had stabbed himself was that they had arrested him while he was committing a robbery or a burglary or something, and he realized that if he stabbed himself, they'd have to take him to the hospital. So he arranged with his girlfriend to bring a car up to the back of the hospital, and he called her on a cell phone, and while they were taking care of the movie star, he escaped. So here's where I am now, moaning and groaning, right? But they had there a surgeon, Dr. Zepeda, Nelson Zepeda, who was an expert in exactly what was wrong with me. What was wrong with me was I had about this much of my intestine that had gone bad. It was dead, and more of it was dying every few minutes. And in a couple of hours, I would have been dead along with my intestine. So he was so good at diagnosing it, he saved me a lot of time. And if I had somebody who didn't know how to diagnose it, I might not have made it. And so pretty soon after I was there, by now I was high on pain and morphine. You know, morphine is very good. I only take aspirin usually, but that was very nice. So he leans down into my face. I can still see his face in looking into mine. He says, "Now here's what's happened. Some of your intestine has gone bad, and we have to cut out the bad part and sew the two good ends together." And I said, "Oh, you're going to do an end-to-end anastomosis." You should have seen his face when I said that. He said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Oh, I did many of them on MASH." And I did. That was the first operation I learned about on MASH. They had invented it for the Korean War. And the funny thing is, while we were shooting MASH, he was watching it while he was in high school. So the two of us came to this evening from a fictional background. So he put me under, and he did the operation. And the way the story ends, I lived. But it's hard to tell this with a lot of suspense, you know. But the funny thing is that I didn't get scared. That really amazed me. I wasn't scared of the possibility that I might die. I started to take care of business. I thought, just before I went under, I thought, you know, I might not wake up from this. So I called over the producer of the television show, and I said, "You know, I want you to tell a few things to my wife, Arlene, and to my children and grandchildren." And he said, "Oh, I'll get a pencil." So So he gets a pencil and a piece of paper, and I start dictating my last words. But the funny, you know, you don't think of very clever things at a time like this, and there isn't a lot of time to rewrite it. You know, I said the most pedestrian things. I love you, and I know you'll I don't know what I said, really. I know you'll carry on the family without me, or something stupid like that. But it really doesn't matter what I said, because he lost the paper. And we two of our daughters came down to visit with me while I was convalescing. Arlene came down, of course, with them. And one of them, Elizabeth, who's got a really funny sense of humor, she said, so wait, you dictated your last words? What did you say? I said, I don't know. He lost the paper. We can't find it. I don't know what I said. She said, you mean you dictated your last words and we don't know what they were? What if you left everything to me? That was the second reassuring thing I heard in Chile. So when I woke up from this, I was euphoric about being alive. I think this happens to most people who nearly die and don't. People, you know, those of us who, and I've talked to a lot of people since then about this, those of us who go up to the doorway and don't go all the way through, we have a special feeling about how amazing it is just to be alive. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're involved in. Every day you think, this is a bonus. This day is a bonus. I wouldn't have had this day. And now it's been 5 years of those days for me. But I still feel that. I was afraid in the beginning that I was going to lose it. Somebody said to me, same thing happened to me, and after about a year and a half, it went away. Don't let it go away. Hang on to it if you can. And that's one of the things I wanted to do. That was one of the things that made me write this book, and the book before it, too. They both came. I got two books out of nearly dying. I don't know what I'm going to have to do to write a third one. That's a little scary. But I was so glad to be alive that I wanted to figure out what I could. In a way, what was I going to do about being alive? Here I had this bonus of a new life that I might not have had. And that, at that moment, that night, I thought I might not get it. So what was I going to do about it? And I started thinking about things I had said to young people over the years, things I'd said to my children, to my grandchildren, things I'd said at commencement talks or I'd talk to young kids graduating. And there's... You know, there's this tendency to give a little advice, to talk about meaning in their lives and values and things like that. And I started to think about that. And I realized that all that time I was probably talking to myself. Because I think when you give advice to people, you're really talking to yourself. You know, you say, well, if I were in your shoes, this is what I would. Well, we're not in their shoes. We're in our shoes, and we think, how would I react to this crisis? You know, we're really thinking to a great extent about ourselves. And so I think when I gave this advice to these kids, I really was talking to them. But certainly when you talk to kids, you're definitely giving advice to yourself. You know, they're not paying any attention. So I thought about this thing about values and meaning. And values are a tricky thing, too. Because even if you're lucky enough to figure out what your values are, it's hard to stick with it. It's hard to live by them sometimes. You know, I was talking about this with my friend Bert Pogrebin. Hi, Bert. And I said, you know, this is a funny thing. I don't like to go fishing. Sometimes people ask me to go fishing, and I don't go fishing because I don't like to kill the fish. But I eat fish. You know, I let somebody else kill the fish for me. I said, I'm a hypocrite. And he said, well, you know, the nice thing about being a hypocrite is you get to hang on to your values. I said, that's very nice. It's realistic, you know. The funny thing was, I actually did start to talk to myself. In the middle of the night one night, I heard this voice in the back of my head. I couldn't sleep late at night. And the voice said, so have you lived the life of meaning? And I thought, what are you kidding? I have a wonderful life. I couldn't be happier. No, really, it said. And I'm talking, I'm hearing this voice. If you didn't wake up tomorrow, would this have been a meaningful life? And I said, oh, come on. But that started this obsessive questioning about meaning for the next year while I thought about this and started to write about it in this book. And I started to look back, and all of these things I had said were all reflective of this, it turns out. Each one of these talks that I gave or moments that I had with my grandchildren dealt with a different way that we have of looking at meaning, looking for meaning. You know, like sometimes people think getting famous will give meaning to our lives. It doesn't give meaning to our lives. It gives you more things to work on. You have more problems. And sometimes, very often, they put rich and famous together in the same sentence. They don't go together necessarily. If you can get rich without being famous, take it. But I thought these things were different ways we have. And I had a lot of things to look back on, because you know, when you get well known enough, they ask you to speak at places where you have no business being. It would sometimes scare me. This one of the earliest times, it really did scare me. Just after MASH hit, I was asked to speak at the commencement exercises of the Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons. You know, I don't know anything about being a doctor. I was really scared that they would think that I thought I knew something about it because I had played a doctor on television. I said to them, you know, maybe they brought me here because they taught you everything they could about how to be a doctor, and now they brought in somebody to show you how to act like one. And I couldn't think of, for a long time, what do I know about any of this that I can speak about intelligently with them. And I realized finally that there was something about medicine that I was actually an expert in, and that was in being a patient. And that's what I talked about with them, and I urged them to be the kind of doctor that listens to their patients. You know, pay attention to us, find out who we are, find out, you know, where we are in our lives, and not just, don't think of us as our ailment. Don't say, take this to the liver in room 213. And I was really impressed that they really responded to that they wanted to be that kind of a doctor. In fact, I was just in Houston, and a doctor who was there that day said he had part of the talk up on his wall, and that he knew other doctors did. And it wasn't such a compliment to me. I think it's a compliment to doctors that they have to learn such hard stuff, but they still want to be able to make that human contact. But the places I've gone are just, I can't believe I went to some of these places and spoke. I think being scared was one of the reasons I went, being scared made me feel like I was, my motor was going and I was really alive. It really was an energizing experience. I was asked once to speak at Monticello about Thomas Jefferson in front of a bunch of historians. So I went. But I had 6 months to get ready for it, so I got, because I was nervous about it, I started reading every book I can find with the word Jefferson in the title. And I went, like, for 2 or 3 months, I'm reading these books, and suddenly I look up from the book and I think, wait a minute, these people who I'm going to be talking to not only read these books, they wrote some of them. What am I going to say that they haven't heard before, but which also has the virtue of being true? I mean, I don't want to just make something up. So I decided to do what I used to do when I was an improviser. I started out as an improviser, and we used to put on a show an hour and a half with no rehearsal. We'd get up on the stage, and we'd invent a show in front of the people. And we used to encourage each other sometimes. We'd say, when you get stuck out there and you can't think of what comes next, reach into the dark and pull out an answer. So that's what I decided to do with this talk. I had only now about a month to go before I had to get up at Monticello. So I thought, all right, I'm going to China next week with the science show. I'm going to interview scientists all around China. I'll find out something in China that no one's ever heard before about Thomas Jefferson. So I went to China and I talked to all these people all over China. Not a single person had ever heard of Thomas Jefferson. Wouldn't you think out of a billion people, one of them would have heard of this guy? There was this one man, a scientist called Yuen Long Ping, who had hybridized rice. And I was standing in this rice paddy up to my ankles in water with Yuen Long Ping. And he said, oh, Jeff Fusson, yeah, independence. And he had heard of him. Not only had he heard of him, but I suddenly realized I was talking to a Chinese Thomas Jefferson. This was really interesting. I'd reached into the dark, and I'm suddenly standing next to the guy. His story was that he had been brought up studying Lysenkoism, which was that Soviet form of fake biology. Lysenko had ingratiated himself with Stalin, and this biology that he called biology that didn't work became the official form of biology, and that spread to China. And in China, when Yuen Long Ping was educated, you couldn't study real biology, which they called Western biology. You had to study Lysenkoism, and you had to teach it. But he knew that the real answers were in traditional biology. So he taught himself biology under a blanket at night with a flashlight. And this was so against the law, he could have gone to jail, I don't know, for maybe the rest of his life, because it was absolutely forbidden. But what he was able to do, once he understood biology, he was so inventive, he figured out a way to cross strains of rice to make hybrid seeds. You know, it's very difficult. Up until Yuen Long Ping's work, you couldn't hybridize rice. The problem was that the sexual organs are too close together on the rice plant. This is a problem many people have, but in order to get one strain to cross with another, you'd have to use a pair of tweezers to get in. You can't do this on a grand scale. So what he figured out was to plant the rice in rows, different strains in different rows, and he had a length of rope. He had one end and somebody had the other end, and a beer bottle in the middle to weigh it down, and they dragged the rope through the field, and one row of rice would bend into the other, and then they had a series of these pollinations that they did, and they got hybrid seeds out of this, and he fed hundreds of millions of people, not only in China, but all over the East. This is so similar to a Jefferson story. Now, here's the Jefferson side of this. Thomas Jefferson, when he was serving in France, was in love with, or infatuated with, a woman in France. So much so that he wanted to impress her one day. They were walking in the park, and in order to impress her, he decided to take a little run and jump over a bush. And he tripped on the bush, he fell down, and he broke his hand. This is one of our great American geniuses. So he said he was going to Italy to recuperate with the broken hand. But that was subterfuge. He didn't need to go to Italy to recuperate. He was going to Italy for a special secret mission, which was he had heard that in the Piedmont region of Italy, they grew a kind of rice that would grow in the highlands in Virginia. And at the moment, the rice that they had in Virginia only grew in the lowlands, in the malarial swamps, and people were dying. So in order to feed his countrymen and save them from this malaria, he was going to go to Piedmont and get rice. The trouble was you couldn't take rice out of Piedmont under pain of death. He went in and he sent two bags of rice by mule down to Genoa to go by boat. And just in case the mule didn't make it, he stuffed his pockets with rice and he crossed the border. And it was against the law. It was under pain of death. You couldn't take rice out. He walked across with the rice in his pocket. So I'm talking to this Thomas Jefferson in China, a guy who risked his life to feed his countrymen with rice, the same thing that Jefferson did. And I felt like for once I could understand him, I could talk to him, I could question him, I could see him and touch him. And I went back and told this to the historians, and they loved it, and I got away with it again. One of the riskiest ones I did was, I was asked to give the Grand Rounds lecture at the Cornell Weill Psychiatric Institute. this is usually given by a psychiatrist, not by someone who it's not enough to need psychoanalysis. Yeah. So I'm thinking now, what am I going to say to these psychiatrists that I might know something about, that they might be interested in? And it suddenly occurred to me, I actually am, I have been observing something all my life that they may not have observed that closely, and that's celebrity. My father was a he became a celebrity when I was 8 years old, Robert Alda. He made movies, he was on Broadway. Okay, so you know him. And I saw, and then when I got well known with MASH, in both cases, I saw what happened to an ordinary family that suddenly had a lot of attention focused on it. It's a startling experience. It changes the way all your interactions occur. And I called the talk there, I thought this would be appealing to the psychiatrist, I called it Celebrity and Its Discontents. Celebrity, it has been good for me in many ways, and it probably is for everybody who gets well known. But it does shift your consciousness. And I've watched it from both sides, because I would be at my father's knee watching people come up to him, and I would see how people are altered a little bit. You know, when we, all of us, including me, when we meet somebody who's famous to us, it changes us a little bit. We get nervous. When I met Lee Volman, the first time I met her, I was speechless. You know, she was my heartthrob from all those Swedish movies, and I'd always see her running through the wheat fields to meet her lover, you know, and her lover was always played by me in these dreams. So I meet her in this parking lot outside a Chinese restaurant at 10 o'clock at night in Hollywood. And we're standing there talking. She's talking, and I can't even hear what she's saying. I see her lips moving, and I'm spellbound. And we're right by the exhaust of the air conditioner of the Chinese restaurant. And these fumes are blowing over us of rancid oil and garlic. And to me, it's the smell of new mown hay as she runs through the wheat field. And then after a couple of minutes, I realized this is just a regular person like me. And I finally could start to hear her talk. But this happens to all of us. You know, this is a very interesting thing. When people meet somebody famous, one of the things that happens quite often is they lose motor control. Their muscles involuntarily tighten and they contract. Before I understood that this was a danger, when MASH first hit, I was in a restaurant in Los Angeles, and there was this kind of big guy, strong guy, sitting at a table in the restaurant, and he said, come over here, I want to shake hands with you. So I went over, and I had to lean over the table to shake his hand. His muscle involuntarily contracted. I fell down all over his roast beef. It's dangerous. You got to watch out for this. The other thing is people lose syntax. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and said, you're my biggest fan. And it's not just me. They say that. I've asked a lot of other people who are well known. They say, yeah, a lot of people say that to me. We lose track of ourselves, you know? The thing is, it would be okay, but it's actually physically dangerous to be famous. We were doing the science show in Italy on one episode, and we were at the Leaning Tower of Pisa. So I walked into the tower with the guy who was the curator, and he knew me from television. So, you know, he was very proud of the tower, and he wanted to show me everything. And he said, you know, this tower is extremely dangerous. There's so much pressure because it's leaning like this, so much pressure on the middle, it won't just fall over. It'll explode. And we're walking to the stairs. You know? So right by the stairs, I see this sign that says, no one permitted beyond this point. I said, do you let people up here? He says, oh, no, but in your case, we made an exception. You know, the same thing happened in Ohio right when MASH was at its height, you know. Arlene and I were driving through this driving rain to get to a dinner theater before the curtain went up. But it was hard to drive because it was coming down in sheets. You could hardly see anything. And through the rain, I can see at a certain point, we're coming to a bridge, and there are police cars with their lights flashing, and there's a policeman at the bridge, and he's going, "Go back! Go back! Don't come this way! The bridge is liable to be washed out! Go back!" And I pulled up, and I rolled down the window. He said, "Oh, I'm sorry! Go right ahead!" You know, you got to be careful not to get sucked into this. I started to drive across the bridge. And Arlene said, "Are you crazy? Back up." You know, sometimes they see you on the screen, they think you must have magical powers. You got to make sure you don't think so, too. But it's dangerous. While we were shooting MASH, two FBI agents came to the set, and they said, can we talk to you in private? I said, yeah. And they said, here's the thing. A young woman has escaped from a mental institution in Florida, and she has a handgun, and she's coming to Hollywood to get even with you and Clint Eastwood. And what had happened was that Clint and I had abducted her in a car 2 years earlier, and we had done something unspeakable to her, and now she was coming to shoot us both. It wasn't me, it was Clint. That's fame. You know, fame is one way we have of looking for meaning in our lives and making money, working for a cause bigger than yourself, devoting yourself to a political life, devoting yourself to your family, loving another person. Art, living a life of art. You know, I've had such a lucky life. I've been involved in all of these things, and I've found meaning in all of them. But I was still looking for some feeling that not just that intellectually I knew that my life had meaning because I had done things I was glad about, but that I had this sense every day that I was alive, and I wanted to keep that sense, somehow regain that sense, if I might ever lose it, of what I had when I woke up the next day in Chile and I found I was still alive. And it was right around this time that for the first time I read a book by Marcus Aurelius. I had all this time I had never read Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius, as I'm sure you know, was this emperor in Rome a couple of thousand years ago who was also, he was a great general, but he was also a great writer. So we had all of this experience, this life experience, plus he could put it into words in the most subtle way. And one phrase of his jumped out at me as I read the book, and it was the right time for me to read it as I was going through all of this. And it was, "All we have is the present moment." You know, what he meant was, it doesn't matter how much glory you pile up for yourself. It doesn't matter what you accomplish. When you're gone, you'll be gone. When you're here, the present moment, that's what you do have. You know, and I just, this summer, we went to Paris, and we went to the big cemetery called Père Lachaise in Paris. And there's a lot of dead famous people there. And they have gigantic monuments. Some of them go all the way up to the ceiling. And you can go to dozens and dozens of these giant monuments and look at the name and not know who the hell it is. The monument lasts a lot longer than the glory does. And I started to really think about this. And one of the reasons it leapt off the page at me was that a couple of years earlier, a scientist I was interviewing on the Science Show, a neuroscientist, said, "You know, our experience of the present moment, of this thing we call now, only lasts about 5 seconds. So as that 5 seconds moves, everything that happened before that 5 seconds is now a memory. And anything that hasn't happened yet is some kind of speculation, but it's not happening now. And that five-second piece keeps moving. You know, so before, when I was telling you about Marcus Aurelius, that's already in the past. And this five-second slice, if you stay with it for a while, it moves on and everything. For instance, when I was telling you before about Marcus Aurelius, that's already in the past again. So I started to think, I wonder if I can actually do that more, be more aware of those 5 seconds. And I started to practice it. Now, this was very interesting. You know, they say writers write to find out what they're thinking, which is really true. But when I speak, I find out what I'm thinking. And when this book came out in hardcover last year, I was going around the country. You know, when a book comes out, you go around the country, you sell it out of the back of your car, you know. So I would go to bookstores and libraries, and I'd talk about the book. And I found myself talking about this present moment thing more and more. I started to realize how much it was meaning to me. And I was doing it. I was practicing it all the time. You know, I know people say, "Oh, be in the present moment." I can't do it all the time. I do it when I decide to do it. I can actually do it. I'm doing it now, and I can see faces. I see colors in faces that I didn't see before. Oh my God! Look at this. This is great. And I hear things. I was at a concert a couple of nights ago, and I thought, "Do that present moment thing." I heard harmonies that I hadn't heard up until that. Earlier that evening. It's really interesting what happens. And I was really, it gets a little nutty, I have to tell you. While I was traveling around, you know, I had to speak a lot. I had to talk on the radio and on television. I get up in front of people at the end of the day. So I couldn't catch a cold. So every day I'd get on an airplane and go to a different city. So I wouldn't touch anything on the airplane. So that's hard. If you have to go to the bathroom on the plane, you have to get in, you have to get out. So I would find a way to open the door so I wouldn't have, but then to close the door, I wouldn't want to touch the handle where the infected people had touched it. So I would grab it up near the top where they wouldn't have touched it, and I'd pull it close and get my hand out of the way really fast, right? So this one time the pilot was standing in the way, I couldn't open it far enough, and when I pulled it shut, my hand didn't get out in time and the door slammed on my finger. So bad, the fingernail eventually fell off. But it hurt so much that my leg was shaking. So I thought to myself, wait a minute, do that present moment thing, see what happens. So I did, as it happened a minute ago, I could see things so much more clearly. I saw the colors on the countertop. And unfortunately, I could smell better, too. And it was. But the funny thing was, letting everything in. I didn't try to keep anything out. I didn't try to keep the pain out or anything. I let everything in. And maybe all that sensory input flooded the feeling of the pain because I didn't feel the pain anymore. I knew it hurt. It was like I had heard an echo of the pain. I knew I was hurting, but I didn't feel it anymore. Now, that may be hard to believe. I'm not sure I believe it. It seems like a crazy story. But I began to rely on this more and more. And it sounds like I'm saying, it's funny, just today, Arlene was at the computer, and she said, look at this on the computer here. It says, I don't know, somebody sent her an email or something, and it said, the past isn't happening now, that's gone, and the future hasn't happened yet. All we have is the present moment. And it turns out Buddha said that. Now, of all the people to copy from me, I can't. Wouldn't you think he'd be a little more gracious? But I think this is not a way, I think it's not, I mean, if there's anything in this, it seems to me to be a reflection of curiosity. It's not a retreat from reality. It actually is being curious about what's happening in front of my nose. And I tie it in with the person who comes closest to being a hero of mine, Richard Feynman. I played him on Broadway once, the reason I got the play started was that I find him such a wonderful character. And Feynman was so curious. Let me tell you a little bit about his story, what happened to him. He was one of the people who helped create the atomic bomb in Los Alamos. And when they were working on that, they were so fascinated with solving the puzzle of the atomic bomb that they didn't think about the destruction that might come out of it. They just loved solving the puzzle. And what happened was, after it went off in Japan and killed all those people, many of the scientists who worked on it got depressed because it finally hit them. And that included him. He was very depressed. He was teaching at Cornell, and he couldn't do his work. He couldn't teach, he couldn't do his calculations. But one day he was in the cafeteria, and I think he had what I would call this present moment thing. He saw a kid tossing a plate up in the air, you know, like you'd toss a Frisbee. And it's just a trivial thing. You could see that happen and then think about something else. But he really saw what was happening, and he was curious about it. As the plate spun, he saw the Cornell emblem spinning around on the plate. And as it spun, he saw it wobble. And he thought to himself, I wonder if there's any relationship between the spin and the wobble. So he started to do calculations. And it was a very complex thing to try to figure out. So he went home and did more calculations. And he did calculations for months after that. And finally, he had a formula, he had an equation that explained the relationship between the wobble and the spin. There was a relationship. And he took it to Hans Bethe, the great physicist who was his mentor, and he said, Hans, look at this. Look, I found the relationship between the spin and the wobble. And Bethe said, well, that's very interesting, Feynman, but what's the significance? He says, there is no significance, it's just fun. But that's what he decided to do for the rest of his life. From that moment on, he decided he would never work on anything that wasn't fun. But what it meant to me was that there's nothing trivial if you pay enough attention to it. Everything has worlds within it. And just as I saw colors in faces a minute ago, you know, now I'm beginning to realize it doesn't make you oblivious of the future or oblivious of the past. It, in a way, because it lets things be there that are really there, I find myself available to thoughts that are rising in my unconscious more readily than I used to because of that. So this is what this whole long thing is about, is that I started out looking for meaning the day after that terrible thing happened to me in Chile. And now I realize that this may not give me meaning, but it kind of obliterates the worry about meaning, because I'm interested in what is happening to me and what's occurring, what's coming up, what people are saying. I find people less boring. It's really amazing. I have listened to somebody who I once thought was boring, and now I think, why is he telling me this? And I start to get interested in his story, and I'm passing the time much more. Otherwise, the time would be like being in prison. So we can have a little conversation and if you have any questions, but I do want to thank you. You've really been fun to talk to. I thank you for being part of this present moment for me tonight. Thank you. Does anybody have a question of any kind? Anybody down here while somebody's coming to the microphone? Do you have any answers?
Here we go.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. I'm a fan of your father's.
Oh. And comes on. It's close.
I saw him in Guys and Dolls.
Pardon?
I loved him.
You love. Hold the microphone closer to your mouth.
Okay.
Thank you.
And you are my favorite doctor in MASH.
Thank you.
I have a question. You said people get rich and they get famous.
I'm sorry, would you say it again?
People get rich and famous.
Yes, yes.
I don't know which comes first. I would think famous and then rich.
Why?
No, you know, you don't always get rich from being famous. I mean, sometimes you could just be, you know, some people who are famous without having any money at all, you could just be at the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong president, you know?
That's true. I think the people of today are smart and intelligent, and they can think for themselves. But I think personalities, rich people especially, and people who are in show business, just express themselves too strongly to us for a number of items. Why do they think it's necessary to you to tell me certain things that I should lean towards? Don't you think we're smart enough to realize what's the right thing?
I agree with you. That's why about 25 years ago, I stopped.
I would like your opinion.
I stopped talking about politics in public. I was very active in politics for 10 years. I tried to get the Equal Rights Amendment, but I tried to help get it passed. But after that, I decided not to talk about it. I decided to spend my time doing what I actually know how to do. You know, this is funny relationship between politics and celebrity. It's very, very odd because politics tries to make use of it when possible, and politicians are often trying to become celebrities themselves. When I was doing MASH, it astonished me. Twice, people came from political parties in New Jersey where we lived, and they said that I should run for U.S. Senator from New Jersey, in Washington, where they make the laws. And I said, I didn't have to think about it. I said, I'm not interested, thank you. I don't know anything about it. I don't want to be a politician. I'm a writer and an actor, and that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I wouldn't know what to do if I was a politician. And they said, yeah, but you could get elected. Can you imagine what would happen if we put somebody in office just because he could get elected? So I don't want to tell you what to think. I do think you're smart enough. I sometimes wonder about the other ones who are not celebrities who tell us what to think. What makes them think we want to hear it either? Anybody else? Yes.
Oh, I appreciated your comment about Richard Feynman because I'm a big fan of his. I hope I got that right syntactically or whatever the expression is. And I appreciated your portrayal of him in QED. I'm just wondering, aside from obviously having to learn your lines, was there any other special preparation that you did to learn about the man?
Well, you know, the people at Caltech where Feynman taught were very gracious to us because they all loved Feynman. They still love Feynman there. He's been dead about 20 years now. And they took us in and I remember sitting with Kip Thorne, great scientists, great physicists, who would explain gluon tubes to me, and we'd go over it and over and over until I sort of got it. And oddly enough, you know, there were a lot of lines to remember because I was on stage by myself almost the entire evening. But the words I said about quantum mechanics, I never had any trouble with because I got so immersed in that it was so important to me to know what I was talking about that I never forgot those words. But it's very complicated. You know, quantum mechanics is very counterintuitive. One of my favorite lines in one of Richard Feynman's books is where he says, and this is all he says, he doesn't say any more than this about it. He says, this is a picture of a positron. A positron is, of course, an electron going backward in time. Don't you love the of course? That's of course an electron going backward into, you know. Now that I never understood, but somebody said they thought he was being funny when he said it. But I mean, he means it. It's a theory, but not explaining it must be an indicative of a great sense of humor. Thank you. Yes.
We You've actually answered my original question. I was going to ask you, because since you've played a politician so convincingly, if you ever had a temptation to go that way, especially because you were quoting Marcus Aurelius and Jefferson, but apparently that's not a temptation. So I'll ask you instead.
Do you rewrite your question?
Yes. No, okay. Well, you're an actor, so the question for an actor, is there a role that you really are dying to be offered and that you feel that's your role and it's yet to be played?
No, I really don't.
No?
I don't. I remember moments on the stage, and sometimes there are moments in that you wouldn't even have heard about, let alone seen. There are two guys from England came here and did a play called The Play What I Wrote, and they had a guest actor who would come in for almost the whole second act. And he'd go in there and do it with almost no rehearsal. And you'd sing and dance and take part in this crazy, stupid farce. And I had, at one point, they were getting me to escape from a French prison dressed as a duchess. So it was really, it was a very exciting thing. I have memories of those moments, but most people don't know what it is. I have a memory of doing a few moments on the West Wing live debate, which was a very exciting time for us. But there's no part that I remember. And the same thing is true when I think of other actors. I don't think of my favorite actor. I think of some moment that I saw him do that was extraordinary, because there was a little moment where he got carried away or she got carried away and was inspired. And that's the kind of thing that I remember, because the rest of it, I'm glad for it to disappear. I don't dote on it. I did this past year. I did two plays. I worked months on them, and we did one for one night, and we did another one for two nights. And it was made me very happy to think that was it. Just went up into the ether, which doesn't exist either.
Thank you.
Mr. Alder, I've never talked in front of this many people in my life. But I've never worn a T-shirt in front of a movie star either. But at the same time, I've told every movie star I've ever met in New York and Newport, Rhode Island, how much I love their work. And they followed me out of the library. This is the first time I followed you into a library, because I didn't want to see Alan Alda, the great artist. I don't know anything about art. But I want to see Alan Alda, the scientist. And boy, did you prove that with your logic, your love of science. And when you said Feynman and Buddha, at the same time, you don't get closer to Buddhism than quantum mechanics. Thank you very much for
that's very
long, heck of an evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Would anyone else like to give testimony? Yes.
Hi, my name is Bruce Raymer. I'm a dealer in old and rare books that specializes in science and medicine and related subjects. A few hours ago, I was talking to another legend, Joe Franklin, who said he was a very good friend of your
father's.
Say
hello, yes.
Yeah, he said to send regards. I was once talking to Steve Riggio from, you know who he is. He's one of the owners of Barnes & Noble. He said, right, you were a collector, and I was wondering whether he was telling me the truth. He said I should send him lists of science books, and that he would offer them to you.
Wait, I missed the last part. What did you say? That?
Steve Riggio said to me to send him lists of books, and he was going to offer them. So I was going to tell you, you can get them directly from me and cut out the middle.
Thank you very much. That not sold in any stores. But wait, there's more. Wait.
But is it true that you're a real collector?
No, I don't collect anything. Okay. No. I don't understand collecting. When I was 50, somebody gave me an umbrella, and I thought, this is good. It had a duck head on it, and I said, I'm going to collect umbrellas now. That's the only umbrella I got now. It's 12 years later, I don't have any. I don't collect anything. I don't like collecting things. What's the point of that? You have to look at them. You have to dust them, and then you have to convince people that they're worth something. They're usually worth nothing, right? Except that they're all in one. I don't mean to run down your life's work. But have you ever thought of doing something else?
I can't.
I'm stuck with this myself.
I thought of being an actor or doing a radio talk show or a TV show.
I missed that last one again. I'm sorry, Shady.
For being an actor or doing
a show,
something like
that. Good. You have a lot of presence.
Thank you. Leno, Letterman.
Thank you very much. But I guess we're getting close. Yes.
I'm not sure whether you answered this question a moment ago, but there was, I'll preface it by saying there was one MASH episode that has always stayed with me. When you, BJ, and Hot Lips were trying to keep a soldier alive on Christmas Day, and BJ kept working on him, and he couldn't save him. You moved the clock. Hot Lips phonied the time of death. And that particular show has always stayed with me. Has any role you've played ever particularly stayed with you? Any episode of any show that you were in stayed with you?
No, and the thing is, I can't remember anything about the one you just said. That was MASH, it wasn't St. Elsewhere?
No, it was definitely MASH.
No, when I was young, and probably still, when I would play a character that had some positive qualities, I would carry those qualities with me off stage. Not the negative ones. I think it would free me. For instance, I remember once when I was in my early 20s, I, for the first time, played somebody who really could lead other people, and he could say, here's what we're going to do next. And every night I saw myself do this, and everybody followed my word, and I thought, I'll keep this up, you know? But otherwise, except for, you know, carrying with me something that seemed like it enlarged me in some way, I don't think I look back on parts I've played. I almost never do. I don't remember what you just said.
Are you limited to 5 seconds? Is that the way it works?
You know, if you could say it in the next 5 seconds, I'll listen. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, Mr. Alda. I've seen you in Art, in QED, and in Glengarry Glen Ross, and I think you're an amazing presence on the stage. And my father always taught me to take a mental picture if I'm experiencing something that I'm enjoying and I want to keep with me always. So that is applying a lot to your being in the present this evening. But because I enjoy seeing you so much in person, I was wondering if you have plans to be in another Broadway show anytime soon.
Well, that's nice of you. Thank you. You know, it's getting harder. I love getting ready to do a play. I love doing it for a couple of months. But having to show up every night at 8 o'clock, whether you feel like it or not, is hard. I'd like someday to do a play where I hang a sign out in front of the theater that says, Alan feels like acting tonight. You know, and just see if that detracts anybody. It was really great when I did QED because we only did it two nights a week. We did it in the theater where Contact was playing during the rest of the week. And on their dark nights, we did QED, and boy, every time I came in, I was ready, the audience was ready. It was really a nice experience. There is something about what I hope for always is so much spontaneity that I never do the same show twice in exactly the same way. But even so, while I'm doing a show, I always love it. It's getting from my house to the theater. That's you know, this was true for Rex Harrison. He did My Fair Lady so many times, so many years. I mean, 8, 10, 12 years. And he did it on the road. He did it all over. I knew the stage manager who was the stage manager of that show. There were times when he'd call up before the show up in Westchester, from Westchester where his house was, and he'd say, I'm not coming in tonight. I don't feel well enough to come in. He was perfect health. The stage manager would have to go up and take him out of the house, put him in the car, and drive him down and make him do the show because it was getting to his brain. He couldn't take it anymore. So whatever it was you said, the answer is no. No, maybe yes. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. Just we'll have to go pretty soon. Yeah, we'll go. Yes. That's probably true. But why did you want to tell us what to think like that?
It's been a pleasure in listening to you tonight. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Thank you. Did you have one last thing? Did you want to say?
Yeah, I was wondering which you enjoy more. Wait. Which is what?
I was wondering which you enjoy more, acting on stage or acting on screen?
Talking to these people tonight. I really did love it. I love being on the stage the most, I think.
One quick question before you go.
Yes.
You mentioned fame a couple times tonight with a sense of reservation. I'm just wondering if any of your children or grandchildren have the desire to be famous, and if not, have you influenced that decision?
What?
I'm just wondering.
You know what happened? When I was in the Army when I was 21 on the firing range. I lost some of my hearing.
I'm just wondering if anyone in your family, your children or grandchildren, have the desire to be famous or in the acting business. And if not, have you influenced the decision?
Yeah, we have a couple of grandchildren, one of whom wants to be, I mean, we have seven grandchildren, but two of whom are interested. One wants to be an actor, and the other wants to be a star. Thank you so much for coming tonight. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.